I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is poet Kay Ryan. Amongst her numerous awards, Ryan served as U.S. Poet Laureate from 2008 to 2010. She appeared at the JCCSF in 2010. And now, join Barbara Lane on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Kay Ryan.
Many of us in Northern California take pride in Kay Ryan as one of our own. California-born, she's a resident of Marin County, and so many of the natural images we find in her poetry are familiar and beloved. But actually, Kay Ryan comes from a different California. The daughter of a well driller, she was raised in the small, dusty, working-class towns of the San Joaquin Valley. And something of that harsh terrain is reflected in her minimalist aesthetic. Kay Ryan's career is outside the mainstream poetry circuit. For over 30 years, until recently, she taught remedial English at the College of Marin, a community college in Kentfield. Needless to say, that's not on the resume of many a U.S. poet laureate. Kay Ryan reminds us of the suggestive power of poetry, how it elicits and rewards the reader's intellect, imagination, and emotions. I'll close by quoting from Publishers Weekly, hot off the press's rave about Kay Ryan's new collection called Best of It, New and Selected Poems. Ryan, the current U.S. Poet Laureate, may well be the oddest and wisest poet to hold that prestigious post. Her tiny, skinny poems pack a punch, unlike anything else in contemporary poetry, although not unlike haiku, if haiku could be cut with a dash of Groucho Marx. Pithy poems manage to encapsulate far more than their few words should be able to hold, as in Bitter Pill, a new poem. A bitter pill doesn't need to be swallowed to work. Just reading your name on the bottle does the trick. Sassy, smart, and deep as they are hilarious, Ryan's poems are among our best, end quote. Please join me in welcoming our U.S. Poet Laureate, Kay Ryan.
Well, nice to see you. Nice to be here. Thank you, Barbara, for that great introduction. I think I should read the rest of Bitter Pill to you. I do write brief poems, but that was even further abbreviated. It's not that I couldn't write a poem that brief, but that was only half of it. Perhaps the better half. Here it is in its entirety. A bitter pill doesn't need to be swallowed to work. Just reading your name on the bottle does the trick. As though there were some anti-placebo effect. As though the self were eager to be wrecked. As with so many of my poems, it stops being funny, you know? People say, your poems are so funny, and I say, wait till you get them home. It's like a fairy gift, you know? And they turn to ash when you get them home. Before I do something like this, I always make a plan. And then later, I don't know what I meant, but it always works. But one needs a plan. I'm sort of related to Martha Stewart in that way. You know, I want things to match in some way. To make sense, you know, the couch and the chairs to go together. This poem is called Flamingo Watching. And it comes from a book that came out in 1994 by that title. And in that book, I was considering a lot of aesthetic questions. And in this case, at that time, poetry seemed to have to be kind of chunky, like chunky peanut butter, you know, with the oil at the top and really a lot of trouble. It was homogenized, you know, it was suspect. Everything had to be natural and it had to be kind of crude. And this is sort of a poem thinking about, well, it actually is a poem sort of thinking about, or a poem thinking about refinement and elaboration and making a case for those things and using the flamingo to do so. Wherever the flamingo goes, she brings a city's worth of furbelows. I should tell you what a furbelow is. A furbelow is like a flounce or a ruffle. And it rhymes, of course, with flamingo goes. And it's ornamental. Wherever the flamingo goes, she brings a city's worth of furbelows. She seems unnatural by nature, too vivid and peculiar a structure to be pretty, and flexible to the point of oddity. Perched on those legs, anything she does seems like an act. Descending on her egg or draping her head along her back, she's too exact and sinuous to convince an audience she's serious. The natural elect, they think, would be less pink, less able to relax their necks, less flamboyant in general. They privately expect that it's some poorly jointed, bland, gray animal with mitts for hands whom God protects. Here's another little contemplation of the of something about something important when you're writing. How much can you give away? How much can you tell? How much can you invite people in? This question is given to a mime. I think it'll make sense to you. How successful can she afford to be? Maybe the mime's test would be to get you to drink from the glass she passed. What if you did grasp it just right? What if it did flash in the window light? Would she be glad if it left a ring? If she could add to the manifest, passing a thing out of the dream? How close to the door can she lean? How genuinely bid you enter, where she herself is a guest on her best behavior? This is spring. You can see it periodically when it quits raining. Like today, it was lovely. And this poem is thinking about a certain quality of people, but it's using trees to think about it. You'll notice that I offload some of my concerns onto other creatures or people. It's called So Different. A tree is lightly connected to its blossoms. For a tree, it is a pleasant sensation to be stripped of what's white and winsome. If a big wind comes, any nascent interest in fruit scatters. This is so different from humans, for whom what is unset matters so oddly, as though only what is lost held possibility. I never read some of these poems, so it's really fun. This is this book to which Barbara referred is new and selected poems. So it's sort of encouraged me to go back to the book Flamingo Watching, from which I'm reading right now, which I think didn't quite get enough play because it came from a really obscure little Rhode Island press. This is called Half a Loaf. And, of course, I'm thinking of the old saw, half a loaf is better than none. And I am somewhat suspicious of that expression and thought. And it refers to a loaf of bread and as its illustrative agent. And I want you to think of the loaf as a loaf you're seeing from the side, okay, uncut. The whole loaf's loft is halved in profile, like the standing side of a bombed cathedral. The cut face of half a loaf puckers a little. The bread cells are open and brittle, like touching coral. It's nothing like the middle of an uncut loaf, nothing like a conceptual half, which stays moist. I say, do not adjust to half unless you must. Now, here's something that I have worried over for a long time. Oh, and this, I won't have to explain what a Kabbalist is here. I think that this is called impersonal. And once again, it comes from a time when all poetry, well, that kind of extends to this time too, but it seems like the assumption would be that poetry would be personal poetry and that it would be directly, you know, first person and dealing with the furniture and events of one's own personal life. And I wanted to think about the impersonal and to argue for it. And I think the first line of this is really funny. It says, the working Kabbalist resists. And I just think it's funny to say working Kabbalist. It sounds like working cowboy. I just like the kind of Marlboro feeling that I get from that. It might be a private amusement, but I'm trying to share it. I'm trying to share it. Impersonal. I think this is exactly the right audience to listen to this poem. The working Kabbalist resists the lure of the personal. She suspends interest in the biblical list of interdicted shellfish, say. You know, where could you say that? I try it and my heart just sinks, you know, but I can do it here. Okay. The working Kabbalist resists the lure of the personal. She suspends interest in the biblical list of interdicted shellfish, say, in order to read the text another way. It might seem to some superficial to convert letters to numerals, or in general refuse plot in favor of dots or half circles. It might easily seem comical how she ignores an obviously erotic tale except for every third word, rising for her like braille for something vivid as only the impersonal can be. A crescent bright as the moon, a glimpse of a symmetry, a message so vast in its passage that she must be utterly open to an alien idea of person. This poem is called Force, and it seems to be starting in one direction, then goes off in another direction. It comes from a time when I was thinking about having to be more forceful, having to use force. And I think it has a very funny line in it. I'll go ahead and tell you so that you can just get your laughter out of the way now. I just love to say this. The Gordian knot just worsens if it's jerked at by a person. I'm shameless in pointing things like that out. Okay. And it appears almost immediately. Nothing forced works. The Gordian knot just worsens if it's jerked at by a person. One of the main stations of the cross is patience. Another, of course, is impatience. There is such a thing as too much tolerance for unpleasant situations. A time when the gentle teasing out of threads ceases to be pleasing to a woman born for conquest. Instead, she must assault the knot or Alp or Everest with something sharp and take upon herself the moral warp of sudden progress. But now let us return to spring. This is called The Hinge of Spring. And as Barbara said, I was raised in Southern California. And during my particularly impressionable youth, I lived on the Mojave Desert. And this is a desert spring poem. And I will say that it has the word rampant in it. And you all know run rampant and so on. But this is using it as an adjective. And it in heraldry, rampant, like the lion rampant, is the lion up on its back legs, right? So here there's a bunny up on its back legs. Okay. The jackrabbit is a mild herbivore grazing the desert floor, quietly abridging spring, eating the color off everything, rampant height or lower. Rabbits are one of the things coyotes are for. One quick scream, a few quick thumps, and a whole little area shoots up blue and orange clumps. Elizabeth Bishop has in a poem of hers the phrase, awful but cheerful. And I think that this is in that category of awful but cheerful. Would you like to hear it again? I thought you would. I just, you know, I could just feel that. The jackrabbit is a mild herbivore grazing the desert floor, quietly abridging spring, eating the color off everything, rampant height or lower. Rabbits are one of the things coyotes are for. One quick scream, a few quick thumps, and a whole little area shoots up blue and orange clumps. Those are lupins and poppies. Okay. I think we've exhausted that pretty much now. I've never been one to wait upon inspiration to write. I think you start, and then if you're really lucky, something will come toward you. In this case, I started with the word persiflage, which you may not know, or you may, but it means banter, light, flippant banter. And so here is a little scenario with persiflage in action. Garden serpents, small as shoelaces, are found in side lots and grassy places. Green coat striped with yellow makes the garden viper a dapper fellow. Don't you wonder when we're going to get to the persiflage part? I'm halfway through. Not a single mention. Birds mock and children chase our minor adder thinner than a pencil. Born sans puff or rattle, he counts on persiflage in battle. Before his flippant tongue, children stiffen. Dogs fall like beef cattle. You're supposed to think of them at the top, you know, they're at the abattoir, and they're getting clonked right then. You know, it's, and once again, it's kind of awful, but I hope kind of cheerful too. At least from the little snake's point of view.
You're listening to poet Kay Ryan, who served as U.S. Poet Laureate from 2008 to 2010 on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Some of you may have gone to a great exhibit at the old Asian Art Museum, Masterworks of Ming. It was wonderful. And I have a poem called Masterworks of Ming. Ming, such a lovely thing, blue and white. Bowls and basins glow in museum light. They would be lovely filled with rice or water. So nice adjunct to dinner or washing a daughter. A small daughter, of course. It's a small basin. First you would put one, then the other end in. The higher enterprise in this poem, which may have escaped you, is just the thought of trying to remove the beautiful from preciousness. You know, the idea of returning the exquisite to service in some way. This poem is called Turtle. It should probably be called Tortoise because it's a land turtle. But when I was a kid, we called them turtles. We didn't call them tortoises, so I guess it's okay. I think they are officially tortoises. This poem comes from a period when I was just terrifically frustrated and had been very, very frustrated for a long time and had to call upon patience, which I didn't have. So this poem exhibits that kind of frustration and pressure that I felt at that time because of the terrific compression of sound and imagery in it. It's just like if you touched it, it was like mousetraps, and it would just springs would just leap up. It's very highly wound. Funny too, I hope, a little bit. And it has my very best rhyme in it. And I will read it once, and then I will ask you if you got it. I'll tell you right now, one word rhymes with three words, okay? And if you know this already, you cannot answer, okay? Who would be a turtle who could help it? A barely mobile hard roll, a four-oared helmet. She can ill afford the chances she must take in rowing toward the grasses that she eats. Her track is graceless, like dragging a packing case places. And almost any slope defeats her modest hopes. Even being practical, she's often stuck up to the axle on her way to something edible. With everything optimal, she skirts the ditch which would convert her shell into a serving dish. She lives below luck level, never imagining some lottery will change her load of pottery to wings. Her only levity is patience, the sport of truly chastened things. Anybody find the rhyme? Don't be shy. Read it again? Okay, but this is the last time. Who would be a turtle who could help it? A barely mobile hard roll, a four-oared helmet. She can ill afford the chances she must take in rowing toward the grasses that she eats. Her track is graceless, like dragging a packing case places, and almost any slope defeats her modest hopes. Even being practical, she's often stuck up to the axle on her way to something edible. With everything optimal, she skirts the ditch which would convert her shell into a serving dish. She lives below luck level, never imagining some lottery will change her load of pottery to wings. Her only levity is patience, the sport of truly chastened things. Anybody get it this time? That's good. You're trying. I mean, you're doing. These are really good in there. They're all rhymes, and I'm very proud of you. But I'm going to give it to you. Okay. Remember the things that she's compared to at first? A barely mobile hard roll, a four-oared helmet, a helmet with four oars coming out of it, right? Okay. Listen to the next line. She can ill afford a four-oared. A four-oared, a four-oared. Right? Great, huh? I did my Olympic, you know, skate at that time. You know, that's the best I ever did. Okay, well, I just am having too much fun. Oh, this poem is called Mirage Oases, and it's another kind of desert poem. Mirage Oases. First among places susceptible to trespass are mirage oases, whose graduated pools and shaded grasses, palms, and speckled fishes give before the lightest pressure and are wrecked. For they live only in the kingdom of suspended wishes, thrive only at our pleasure, check. I think I'll read that again. It's very common for me to read things again. I think I don't get things very well through my ears. I much prefer to see poems on a page, and I have a lot of sympathy for audiences who are trying to hear a poem. Mirage Oases. First among places susceptible to trespass are mirage oases, whose graduated pools and shaded grasses, palms, and speckled fishes give before the lightest pressure and are wrecked. For they live only in the kingdom of suspended wishes, thrive only at our pleasure, checked. I was invited to something called the Aspen Ideas Festival, where they all the people there pride themselves on their interest in ideas and making connections and thinking the big thoughts and synergy and all kinds of things that make me sick. So I was given a little slot to read for like 5 minutes, and so I could only read 6 poems. But I made sure that they were all really opposed to the ideas dear to the hearts of those people. And here is one. It's called Connections, and it's about essentially hating connections. Connections lie in wait, something that in the ordinary line of offenses makes offense more great. They entrap, they solicit under false pretenses, they premeditate. They tie one of your shoelaces to one of a stranger. They tie strings to purses and snatch as you lean down, eager for a little something gratis. If you were reading this, you could read snatch as and gratis as kind of rhyming, but I have to point it out to you. But it will increase your pleasure. I will read it again. See, this shows the real ugly underbelly of connections. Connections lie in wait, something that in the ordinary line of offenses makes offense more great. They entrap, they solicit under false pretenses, they premeditate. They tie one of your shoelaces to one of a stranger. They tie strings to purses and snatch as you lean down, eager for a little something gratis. This poem is called Bestiary, and you might think that I'm mispronouncing bestiary, and I would have thought that too at one point, until I noticed the spelling, which is actually bestiary, even though bestiaries are compendia, I don't know, of animal descriptions, you know, real and fantastic both. This was one illustrated by Alexander Calder and collected by the wonderful Richard Wilbur. Well, they're both wonderful. And I don't like learning, and so it was very upsetting to me to find out that I'd been wrong and had to change my pronunciation. So I wrote a poem. A bestiary catalogs bests. The mediocres, both higher and lower, are suppressed in favor of the singularly savage or clever, the spectacularly pinchered, the archest of the arch deceivers, who press their advantage without quarter, even after they've won, as of course they would. Best is not to be confused with good, a different creature altogether, and treated of in the goodiary. A text, alas, lost now for centuries. You know, I said I don't like learning, so I should read a poem that I also read at the Aspen Institute called Learning, and it's against learning. And my new book has a title index, and I am so excited, because when I have an idea like this, I don't have to plow through four books searching for this. I can just go to the L's and find out where it is. And there it is. Learning. Whatever must be learned is always on the bottom, as with the law of drawers and the necessary item. It isn't pleasant, whatever they tell children, to turn out on the floor the folded things in them. These didn't go over very well at Aspen. Well, you know, actually, the strange thing that happened at Aspen was I was sort of like a breath mint in between you know, generals and captains of industry and things like that. And so it was a theater that it was outdoor theater that seated like 6,000 people, and I was so excited. But you know, they all got up and went to the bathroom during my reading. It was their only break, you know. So it was, all in all, I was really glad that I hit them as hard as I did. Yeah. I have long used the Ripley's Believe It or Not as a source of inspiration. And this poem, A Plain Ordinary Steel Needle Can Float on Pure Water, has had a marvelous life beyond what I could ever expect. It's not really that special an idea if you think about it. I mean, I think a lot of you in your dull childhoods put a needle on top of water, discovered that it could rest there if you were very careful. But this poem has been used at weddings. The first time I was told that, I just couldn't even believe it. And then somebody else came and told me that they'd read this poem at their wedding. I mean, you could understand it in the Bay Area, but, you know, this was like elsewhere. Midwestern people, you know. Who hasn't seen a plain, ordinary steel needle float serene on water as if lying on a pillow? The water cuddles up like jello. It's a treat to see water so rubbery, a needle so peaceful, the point encased in the tenderest dimple. It seems so simple when things or people have modified each other's qualities somewhat. We almost forget the oddity of that. I want to tell you, this was in the New Yorker. I mean, that's of course, I'm very proud of that, but that's not what I wanted to tell you. Their fact checking is so great that I used Jell-O in here, you know, and I got the poem. I got a query about Jell-O, and I had to spell it capital J E L L hyphen capital O. You know, I hadn't spelled it like that. You know, I didn't know that I had to do that, but I did. There are many things you discover there. You know, after they used it for the wedding, I could see it better. You know, I could see that. When I first tried to sell this poem, I tried to sell it for years and couldn't get anybody to take it. And then I added "or people." Because, see, when I think about things, I don't make a big distinction between things and people. It's just the way I am, you know. But when I put in "people," it was sort of like people could understand that this might relate to people more than if I left people out. That was a big lesson for me. Oh, I should read this, because this sort of suggests my various problems with warm-blooded or not, you know, and my inability to entirely distinguish. This is called Heat, and it has a statue in it, and it's the one of the... Who's the architect of our great park? Who's the architect? Olmsted? Okay, so it's a statue of Olmsted. Pardon? McLaren? Oh, McLaren. That sounds better, yeah. Okay, McLaren. Yeah, so this is a statue of McLaren that makes a little appearance in here. And then some mannequins from, you know, Macy's or something. There, and rocks, too. Heat. There is a heat coming off anything we meet, R-sized and mildly round. Who has not found herself warmed by certain stones, for example, or made occasional mistakes about things that didn't turn out to be people? That's really funny to me. Perhaps we share a shape that loves itself, a heat anterior to life, further back than hearts. I postulate a very early date for when the warming starts. You know, we write to give ourselves company. You know, I read that and I go, so true, so true. This poem is called Corners. I talk to myself a lot in cheering bromides or cautionary bromides. This one is cautionary. Don't paint yourself into a corner, right? Apparently I felt that I had here. All but saints and hermits mean to paint themselves toward an exit, leaving a pleasant ocean of azure or jonquil ending neatly at the door sill. But sometimes something happens, a minor dislocation by which the doors and windows undergo a small rotation to the left a little, but repeatedly. It isn't obvious immediately. Only toward evening and from the farthest corners of the houses of the painters comes a chorus of individual keening, as of kenneled dogs someone is mistreating.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is poet Kay Ryan, who served as U.S. Poet Laureate from 2008 to 2010. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
think it's time for me to read a few poems that are from the new section, which is in the front of the book. And I had thought that I would read this little poem called Train Track Figure. Since you're only hearing it, I'll give you a little help. Think of you standing on one side of a train track, train going by, and something on the other side that you're trying to see. Okay. Imagine a train track figure made of sliver over sliver of between car vision. Each slice too brief to add detail or deepen. That could be a hat if it's a person, if it's a person, if it's a person. Just the same scant information timed to supplant the same scant information. Here's a poem called Ledge. Birds that love high trees and winds and riding flailing branches hate ledges as gripless and narrow, so that a tail is not just no advantage but ridiculous, mashed vertical against the wall. You will have seen the way a bird who falls on skimpy places lifts into the air again in seconds. A gift denied the rest of us when our portion isn't generous. Oh, I want to read this poem because it has an epigraph by our own John Carroll from the San Francisco Chronicle. It's called Easter Island. Here's what John Carroll said. The people of the island built those amazing stone statues and in the process cut down every last tree. No trees, no wood for houses and fires, no protection from erosion, no useful species, and so on. It worked without a hitch. The last big head rolled down the last logs to its niche. As planned, a long chorus of monoliths had replaced the forest. Staring seaward, nicely spaced, each with a generous collar of greensward, and prepared to stand so long that it would be a good trade, life for the thing made. This is a kind of an interesting contemplation, I think. It's called pentimenti. And I sort of knew that word, but I was in the Frick Museum in New York, and one of the paintings had a little sign that said, pentimenti of an earlier position of the arm may be seen. And pentimenti are things that the painter thought better of, right? They repented the position of the arm and painted it out and painted a new one in. And sometimes those can be seen through the paint after a few hundred years. Pentimenti. And I'm going to read this one twice because I think I need to for you to understand it. It's not simply that the top image wears off or goes translucent. Things underneath come back up, having enjoyed the advantages of rest. That's the hardest part to bear. How the decided against fattens one layer down, free of the tests applied to final choices. In this painting, for instance, see how a third arm, long ago repented by the artist, is revealed, working a flap into the surface through which who knows what exiled cat or extra child might steal. I'll read it again. It's not simply that the top image wears off or goes translucent. Things underneath come back up, having enjoyed the advantages of rest. That's the hardest part to bear, how the decided against fattens one layer down, free of the tests applied to final choices. In this painting, for instance, see how a third arm, long ago repented by the artist, is revealed, working a flap into the surface through which who knows what exiled cat or extra child might steal. I'll end with a poem found its inspiration in a painting by Zurbaran, the 17th century Spanish painter. It's very beautiful, still life. It's called Still Life with Lemons, Oranges, and a Rose. And some of you will know that painting. It's very beautiful. There are three, you know, the lemons are separate from the oranges and the rose. It almost feels like three separate still lifes on just a very flat forward plane, a tabletop. And the thing that's just glorious to me about it is that the fruit seems almost suspended, you know, like it isn't really, it doesn't have any gravity. Anyhow, the fruit feels like it's not, it doesn't have any weight. It's this beautiful, beautiful quality to it. So this is from Zurbaran's point of view. Like two giant's hands, shade and gravity collude to squeeze away the light and leave the clay, rude Zurbaran, which means he has to find a counter way to paint, unless he wants his oranges too to stick, glued into a lump like candy. And now his wife is sick. Thank you.
Kay Ryan. So those of you with questions, we just need to see hands up in the air. And if you need a minute to get going, I'm going to start off and ask you a really obvious question, but we talked about it a little bit earlier. I know you said you love rhyme, and Nicholson Baker has written recently in a novel about rhyme. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I'd be happy to. I'm teaching a little class. I mean, by little, I mean brief class at Stanford right now, a place I'm very unaccustomed to being. And I've been talking a lot about rhyme. I love rhyme, and I think it's one of our earliest pleasures. Children rhyme spontaneously. They don't have to be encouraged to do it. They'll just say hat, cat, bat, mat, pat. One of my students at Stanford was saying that his little neighbor started out with duck, and he knew it was just a matter of time till the kid got in trouble, you know. And sure enough, it happened. So the kid's immense delight, not knowing it was coming, you know. Rhyme is just a great deal of fun. And I mean, it's almost cheating to use rhyme, because rhyme so successfully glues work together. It creates a kind of a bond in language that is lovely. And another thing it does is that if you are bewitched by rhyme, if you're kind of shanghaied by rhyme as I am, it keeps you from being as pedestrian as you would have been. Because, you know, you get one word out here, like Mike, and then all sorts of words come and want to be in your poem with it, you know, rhyming words. So that it's quite lovely to try to be going someplace and then have all these words come and mob you and want to be in your poem. So it makes you more experimental than you might have been otherwise.
I read somewhere, and you can tell me if this is true or not, that you were inspired to write a poem for each card of the tarot deck. Is this true? And if it was, could you say something about what that process was like for you? And
I actually did use the tarot deck when I was just beginning to write. I didn't know how to write, and I insisted on teaching myself. I'm an autodidact. I cannot be taught, anything. And so I had this tarot deck in the 1970s, and I didn't have the patience to learn to read the cards. But I did read deeply enough into the book to learn to shuffle them. So I wanted to write, but I didn't know how to write. So I would shuffle this deck in this great tarot way, and I would turn one card over each day. And whatever card I turned over, I was compelled to write about. So it might be the Hierophant, which is very cool because I had no idea what a Hierophant was. Or it might be Death or the Hanged Man or Strength or the Seven of Wands, you know, or the Three of Cups or whatever. And I was compelled to write about that. And the beauty of that for me was that there were any number of things I didn't want to write about, like something that said love, you know, that would be the title of my poem, Love, because that's the card I got. Or The Lovers, I can't remember what it was. Oh, I just so didn't want to do that. But I had to. So I found all kinds of ways to, I found ways to write about things that wouldn't have been my choice. So it was a marvelous exercise. And when I got to the number of cards that there were in a tarot deck, and I don't remember right now, I quit. And so some cards I had to describe three times, and other cards I never described. So it was an excellent exercise, and I named the book Face Up. I thought that was funny. And it never went anywhere. I sent it to the tarot company. I thought they'd be really excited. They were less excited than I thought they would be.
Hi.
Hi.
This actually turns out might be a little bit connected to your last answer, but I was thinking that, you know, it seems like a lot of the origins from your poems come, for your poems, come from either a single word or a rhyme or a painting.
They don't come from rhymes. The poems get a lot of torque from rhyme, but they don't start
okay.
with rhyme.
Yeah. Okay. But maybe a word.
Yeah, know, maybe that, a word.
That's
yeah.
interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet they have a lot of deep meaning. So I guess what I was curious about was to just hear a little bit about sort of the leap from the word to what the poem's about beyond that.
Well, gee, that's such an interesting question, but I have almost no idea how to answer it. You know, I think that, and this is probably very unfashionable, but I'm not very satisfied with poems unless they do have a lot of, they have some depth to them. That's the reason I didn't want to be a poet to begin with. I didn't want to have depth. I really wanted to be superficial. I mean, I'm not kidding. I did want to be superficial. But I think that it's just natural to, when you're, I don't know, if you stand in quicksand, you sink, you know, and since everything is quicksand, I just start sinking into whatever surface I'm standing on starts giving away, and then I'm in over my head. Gee, that was pretty good. Thank you. You know, these questions and answers are always really touch and go, you know.
Thank you. I was interested in how, having spent formative years in the desert, how you feel that influenced your writing beyond just subject matter.
You know, there's absolutely no way, unless I had a test me, that I could have put in Oregon, you know. I mean, you know, if I'd had a rainforest self, I might know. I do know that I think I have a taste for emptiness and empty places. And I don't know, and for sensory deprivation, you know, I'm always saying, less please, you know, could I have a little less, you know? unless it's drink, then I like more drink. But I don't know. It's just, I think it's just one of those impossible things to say. I do love desert landscape, and I love the fact that nothing is so empty that there isn't really a lot there. You know? I mean, nothing. It doesn't matter how small or barren a square inch you're down to. There's still just more than enough there. So I think maybe the fact that I'm easily overloaded by sensation made it very lucky that I lived with a mother who couldn't stand any excitement at all in a place that offered no excitement.
Hi, thank you for the reading. I wanted to ask about the position of Poet Laureate. And, I mean, we all know too much about the Academy Awards and how you're on the list and you're nominated, yeah, and yeah. then, you know, we wait with bated breath to yeah. see who... But was there a short list, and did you know you were on it, or did they just call you in the middle of the night and tell you congratulations? I mean, how does the whole thing work?
Well, you have to sleep with the Librarian of Congress. I never said that before, and I'm so glad I said it. Turns out he is a lovely man, so it's not that bad, you know. This is how it's done. The choice of the Poet Laureate, which is a one-year appointment, which can be renewed once, is entirely in the hands of the Librarian of Congress. He consults, he told me, with about 50 poets and I don't know who all, people whose opinion he really values. But he said about 50. And he does this every time. And, of course, this is Dr. James Billington. And over the course of many years, he knows a great deal about contemporary American poets and poetry. And in his mind, he says he has maybe 5 or 6... finalists a year, or every time he makes the appointment. And he said that he reads all of their work, you know. And so over the course of the years, he would have done this so many times that he's probably got a pretty big list of people that he knows an awful lot about. So I think it's kind of nice in the way it's not done by committee, you know. I mean, so many things are done by committee and kind of get generalized in that way, so that we get all sorts of eccentric choices for Poet Laureate, which I think is great. Yeah.
Thanks to all of you for being here, and thanks so much to Kay Ryan.
Thank you.
Good evening.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was poet Kay Ryan, who served as U.S. Poet Laureate from 2008 to 2010. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalet, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.